Hello there. Welcome to the program. Is today's liberalism still the Enlightenment ideal of free thought and individual rights? Or is it just about money and sex? The freedom to shop and the freedom to shag, you might say. And has religion surrendered to this new ideology? This is the Religion and Ethics Report, and I'm Andrew West. Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed, was a surprise bestseller in the US, propelled to the top of the chart because former President Barack Obama said it was on his 2018 reading list. Patrick's a political scientist at Notre Dame University, and as he was finishing his book, Patrick Deneen wondered if liberalism's biggest and unintended failure was the presidency of Donald Trump.
Well, I think a certain reaction to some of these consequences of liberalism has in fact had the kind of blowback effect of producing at least, let's say, the conditions for Donald Trump. I'm not going to say it inevitably was going to produce Donald Trump per se. But Donald Trump is part of, I think, and I'm not the first to recognize this, part of a general reaction to a world in which you could say our sort of cultural markers have been flattened and a sense of that we have a kind of common life and a common fate that we share together has been weakened.
Well, you've been working on this book for quite a while, so I thought it was rather prescient that you say that liberalism itself seems likely to generate demotic demands for an illiberal autocrat. I mean, it does sound like we could be talking about the political trajectory, not just in the United States, but definitely the US is part of the pattern.
Right. So the irony is that the liberated individual self, it turns out, becomes quite needy to especially the growth of the state and the provision by the state of supports for this increasingly liberated self. In the United States, we tend to think that there's this vast divide between what you could say is individualism on the one side and statism on the other side. And part of my argument is that the two tend to grow together. And the irony is that tends to be then the people, we could say, who are the most anti-statist, who have increasingly turned to the power of the state, and especially now to a figure like Donald Trump, to correct things.
Yeah.
And so you do have this puzzling and curious anti-government passion that the government should correct things.
Yeah. Look, we should just very briefly and concisely define your understanding of liberalism here.
Right. So I don't mean liberalism in the American context. We think of liberalism as the left side of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
And it's funny, my book title has ended up generating a lot of invitations for me to speak with a lot of right-wing radio stations who are thinking that it's good news that liberalism failed. And I tell them, well, it's actually not necessarily the best news. If by this I mean not only the political left, but also what we think of as our contemporary conservatives. So by liberalism, I really mean the sort of the deeper political philosophy that really animates, I would say, most of the Western liberal democracies. And at the core of certainly the kind of what I would say is anthropological assumptions of liberalism or the theories of human nature is the idea that we are by nature, and we think of the state of nature theories, we're by nature individual selves, and that we conceive of ourselves primarily as individual selves. And we can contrast this to, let's say, contrast it to what it was liberalism was formed in opposition to, which was, let's say, an aristocratic order and an aristocratic
feudal
world,
order. Yeah.
A feudal order, precisely, in which who you were was basically defined by who you came from and where you were born. And myself, as a kind of a creature of liberalism, I don't like that idea necessarily, that I'm merely defined by what my father's name was. So literally, if you were a smith, you were a smith. And
yeah.
If you were a weaver, you were a weaver. And so liberalism conceives us first and foremost as individuals who define ourselves and define our own horizons.
Yeah.
But you could say that this theory of liberation, while welcome and needed in a time in which we were too tightly defined by these other definitions, has led in the opposite direction, which is a kind of fragmentation and atomization in our society.
Well, the phrase liberal democracy, though, today seems very loaded because it seems to mean these days less constitutional democracy, that is, you know, checks and balances on elected power, and much more a country where permissive or libertarian values prevail. That seems to be what people think liberal democracy is about.
Yeah, that's been a striking aspect of, I think, the reaction to my book, which is that I do take to task, I would say, the libertarian aspect of both of our political parties. And I don't know how this lines up in Australia. It may have some similarities. But effectively, that our political right is, on the one hand, it pronounces a great devotion to and support for family values and kind of old-fashioned values of family and home and community, but while endorsing a globalized economic system, and in particular a much more libertarian economic system that often works at odds with those kinds of communal values and norms. And on the political left, we have those who want to argue that we need a kind of more moralized economy, and so we need a kind of moral considerations of the ends and purposes of economics. But of course, on the personal side, thinking here of the advance of the sexual revolution and redefinition of the family and so forth, you see a kind of libertarian side to the left as well. And one of the things that I point out is that in a liberal society, it turns out that those two parts of the agenda, both the left and the right, tend to be what wins. It tends to, in other words, the more libertarian side of what seem to be opposite political parties ends up fitting into the grooves of liberalism itself. And that part which doesn't fit into those grooves tends not to win. And so while we think we're opposed to each other, what tends to win out at the end of the day is a kind of single vision of this liberated human person, right?
Well, it seems to me, forgive the colloquialism, that a lot of modern liberalism comes down to freedom to shop and, freedom to shag, as they say. And that's about it.
It seems that, right, we're defined more and more as customer or consumers and less as citizens. And I think that's absolutely right. And in some ways, you could say these two things ultimately merge, that the freedom to shop and the freedom to shag, as you put it, end up being in many ways similar. And, you know, you can think of the pornification of culture.
Yeah.
Sexuality is really just one consumer good, among other things, and how much consumer goods are basically sold through sexuality and the appeal, what we used to be called sex appeal. So that the two really do begin to merge. And this is really one of the points of the book, is to really argue that so many of our titanic, what seem to be kind of irresolvable political debates at the level of everyday politics, tends to obscure how deeply consistent the general tendency of liberal societies tends to be over time.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you. I'm speaking with Patrick Deneen. Patrick is a professor at Notre Dame University in the US. His latest book is Why Liberalism Failed, and it's been getting some excellent reviews. Patrick, let's talk about religion. How has religion either adapted itself or distorted itself, I guess, depending on where you stand, to accommodate liberalism?
Well, I guess you could say in the first place, and of course, one of the explanations for the origins of liberalism is that it's a way for us to manage what were, of course, very deep divisions within the West, within especially Europe, over the wars of religion or the divisions within Christianity itself. And so that liberalism in part comes into being by explaining itself that this is a way for us to sort of have a modus vivendi, a way that we can live together with very strong differences of religious viewpoints. But here again, I think that there's a kind of a deeper story to be told. And I don't necessarily go into this in the book, but I think it's consonant with the book, which is that over time, much like we could say the decision whether or not to have a family and whether or not to have children and whether or not to even align oneself with a nation or think of oneself as a member of a nation, much less a community, that this applies as well to religion, and that religion is increasingly seen as something that needs to be privatized, that it becomes a matter of opinion rather than in some ways something that can be introduced into the public sphere. These are debates that were had strongly in the 1980s and 1990s. Is religion permissible in the public square, or is it really just a kind of a private belief that ought to be kept to oneself? And again, what we're seeing as a matter of sort of factual social facts on the ground is a widespread abandonment of religious belief and religious affiliation the more one moves through the generations from an older generation to a younger generation, that the disaffiliation of this liberated individual self is showing itself, of course, in our religious lives as well. And I would just submit that while liberalism comes into being claiming that you can retain and indeed can have a vibrant and vivid religious life and strong religious affiliations, that's certainly what we've seen across the Western world, the Western liberal democracies, is in effect. And in fact, what's happened is that liberal democracy has proven to be the greatest eliminator of religious belief, far more than any totalitarian regime that ever attempted this. Russia couldn't do it. The Soviet Union couldn't do it. Fascism couldn't do it.
Mao's China couldn't do it.
Mao's China hasn't done it. But what's fascinating is that if you invite people to think of themselves essentially as liberated and free individuals, as shaggers and consumers, as you put it, religion becomes a very unattractive option.
Yeah, I mean, much of this liberal tendency in religion has been about being inclusive. I mean, are there limits to inclusiveness?
Well, I suppose what's meant by inclusive is itself interesting to reflect upon. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the exclusivity of contemporary elite institutions. So I teach at an institution like many contemporary elite universities where inclusivity is much of the language of the day, including those and extending a hand outward. But these are at the same time some of the most exclusive institutions that have ever existed in the history of the world. It is very difficult to get admission into one of these institutions. You know, 5%, 10% admissions rates at our top universities. So I suppose the language of inclusivity applies to certain things, but it doesn't apply to other things. And what strikes me is that at the very time one is talking about inclusivity, one is also defining and attempting to redefine a world in which to be included means to have to adopt certain views and certain accepted norms. And I talk about this in one of the chapters in the book. At the heart of this is the acceptance of, and it seems to me, the kind of effort to extend what I call the anti-culture, a kind of the transcendence of any particular culture, in preference to a world that's been largely flattened. So, of course, inclusivity is, we could say, it is the norm of our age. And you ask me, is there a limit to inclusivity? And I would say inclusivity itself has its limits, which is who is included. Who is to be included within the inclusivity circle, we could say, has to meet a certain bar of what proves to be acceptable.
I'm just thinking there are obvious reasons for as much inclusivity as we possibly can achieve when it comes to people's ethnic or racial or physical sort of natural backgrounds, as it were. But, you know, it's just plainly wrong and idiotic to discriminate against people on the basis of their skin colour or the shape of their nose or the texture of their hair. But are communities required to include in themselves those who have, let us say, values that would destroy the community as we know it?
Yeah, I think this is one of the great conundrums. I pose this as an unanswered question or a question that's difficult to answer. So you're right, it's ridiculous to discriminate on some of these ascriptive features. You know, going back to Plato's Republic, he says, why would we judge people based on their eye color or the length of their hair? He recognized the silliness of this. But at the same time, it seems to be also simply built into the fabric of our human nature to say that we will care about things and we will care about each other when we feel a sense that we belong together. And that's been typically in the form of families. It's been typically in the form of communities. And in the world we've grown up in, it's been in the world of nations. And one of the things that's being tested now is it possible for human beings to care, in a sense, about everyone, to care about the globe? And one of the great political contestations taking place right now is humanity, in some sense, ultimately destined to think of ourselves as humanity and as these global creatures? And can we adequately care about each other and care about the globe? Or are we creatures that sort of need to be in sort of containers, right? Yeah. Whether it's national containers or families. And if you think about it, two of the most contested areas today in our politics, and even in kind of the philosophical, theological realm, is the question of the status of the nation and the question of the status of the family. And so if, in fact, we are bounded creatures and need these kinds of boundaries, does it make sense? And is there a way to justify the existence of the nation as the kind of carrier of certain kinds of commitments? Just as we ask the question, is it the case that the family is the carrier of certain kinds of commitments? And I take the view that liberalism, if it follows its own tendencies, it will ultimately want to weaken and even eliminate the ties, certainly of the nation, and quite possibly the ties of the family. And whether or not human beings can sort of flourish in such conditions, it seems to me, is a question that I'm certainly not sanguine about.
On the Religion and Ethics Report, you're with me, Andrew West. I'm speaking with Patrick Deneen of Notre Dame University about his latest book, Why Liberalism Failed. Patrick, as I'm reading Why Liberalism Failed, especially when you discuss individualism, I'm reminded of a BBC documentary I heard a few years ago about what has become in Sweden the notion of statist individualism. It would seem completely paradoxical, but you bring it out in a way that's very real. How does this obsession with the individualism, which has good things, freedom of expression, freedom to be ourselves, but how does it also lend itself to this often overbearing state?
In this regard, I really am simply a pupil of Alexis de Tocqueville, who observed this long time ago, observed this in the 19th century.
And de Tocqueville, we should just remind people, was the Frenchman who travelled about America in the early 19th century and wrote his observations, I think, in about 1830, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1835 was the first volume, and 1840 the second volume of a book that's titled Democracy in America. It's the text that we, in some ways, most can benefit from in thinking about our contemporary condition. Tocqueville describes essentially what he foresees as the rise of what you describe as statist individualism, or what this BBC documentary described as statist individualism. And it's precisely that the more we achieve this condition of liberating ourselves from others, and we can think of this in terms of liberating ourselves literally from other people, but also liberating ourselves from the past, the kind of generational obligations we may owe, the gratitude we may owe to the past, as well as liberating ourselves from the future, of saying, you know, future generations are on their own and they'll have to take care of themselves. You know, the kind of indebtedness that we now leave our children in, literally in the debt that we're giving to them, is kind of one way of seeing this. It's the condition, the ground condition, I would say, the realization of liberalism, the condition of liberating the self from other human beings, past, present, and future. And as a result of this freedom, there's sort of no one else to rely upon anymore. You could say we're free from other people, but we're also, you know, no longer reliant upon other people, and no one owes us anything in an interpersonal way. Mm. And this is where the kind of the statist element comes in, which is that it turns out that the only entity that can now sort of provide for us becomes the state. There's a feedback mechanism here, which is that the state, which you could say has an interest in empowering itself, is more than happy to provide benefits and goods to us, because the more it does so, the more we're liberated and the more we come to rely upon the state. Yeah. So there's a kind of, there's a feedback loop in which the individual feels itself empowered while the state is literally empowered as a result of both our strength as individuals but our weakness as individuated selves.
I mean, in very concrete terms, as this BBC documentary brought out about Sweden, you don't give to charity because the state takes care of everything. You don't shout someone or pay for someone's dinner. You don't even take them something to eat if they've moved in next door in your apartment block, because then they'll feel they have a sense of obligation. It's quite stuck.
Well, I think of it too. You know, I think it's always been a civilizational norm that when you're a child, your parents take care of you. And when your parents grow old, you take care of your parents. You know, you could say every civilization has observed this sense of obligation of the old to the young and then the younger to the old. And we could say that one of the key features of liberalism is to break this pattern, that one of the things that we value is the liberation of being an adult. Yeah. And to have to take care of one's parents becomes a deep burden and a kind of very, a great limitation on our liberty. And so one consequence, it seems to me, is to rearrange society so that we don't have to care for our old. So we literally sort of farm out our elderly down to Florida. We say, it's nice down there, go live down there, and we'll pay for some people to take care of you. Or increasingly, the state will take care of you. But does the state take as good care of our parents as we might take care of our parents? I dare say probably not.
Yeah, but you see, the tension here, though, Patrick, is, and this is where the political right has to take responsibility, because the political right has said in most countries, look, what matters is moving where the jobs are. This was the dictum of Mrs. Thatcher. It's the dictum of some politicians in Australia. You have to go where the jobs are, which may mean deserting your your family. I mean, how does this economic liberalism actually destroy the very conservatism that the traditional right claims to embrace?
Part of the argument in my book that I think has been greeted with the most scorn and denunciation by people on the right, which is that I say if you really do care about things like family values and the obligation of generations to each other, and I even dared to say that if you are pro-life and you're anti-abortion, then you better take a hard look in the mirror and reconsider your sort of unbridled support for the economic liberalism or capitalism that is otherwise such a core part of your platform. Because it seems to me there's nothing more that undergirds more this idea of ourselves as these liberated individual selves, and that in many ways is the tool of this vision of human liberation than the economic order that has been otherwise supported by the right.
Yeah. There is another big tension, and this was one of the criticisms that a couple of the reviews of your book seem to suggest, and that is small-scale communities are great if they're full of people who love each other, perhaps if they're physically beautiful places, if it's a village in the Cotswolds in England or a town in New England with a duck pond and a library and a clock tower, if they're nice places to be. But what if these places, these local communities, are remote, they're impoverished, they're filled with people who are understandably frustrated and bitter and suspicious of others? I mean, that isn't a recipe for good local life, is it? And you can understand why people, through their individualist impulses, want to get out.
Right. Another chapter of the book, I talk about the rise of what I call a new aristocracy. And we began by talking about liberalism as the effort to overturn the old aristocracy, this idea that your position in life is given to you by your birth, which, of course, was one way you perpetuated the aristocracy. If you're born to an aristocrat, you are an aristocrat. But the nature of the new aristocracy, I suggest, is, in fact, encourages and I would say promotes and undergirds precisely what you're describing. And at one point in the book, I compare the creation of the new aristocracy as a kind of strip mining operation. And if you're familiar with strip mining, you know, you basically strip out all the valuable coal veins in a particular place and you put that coal into production and it gets burned somewhere else. And I say we're basically people who work at universities like I do are engaged in the equivalent, the sort of human equivalent of strip mining operations, which is to identify really valuable human resources and to strip mine them or to invite them to accept them into top universities, top institutions, and to make them sort of, we refine them, turn them into economically productive entities, and then we send them out into the stream of commerce where they end up then congregating in very nice places like Washington, D.C., or I assume Sydney and places like that. But what the result of this is that I think what you're describing as kind of the stunted local places end up being deprived, or we could say depleted, of the kind of human resources that might once have made and contributed to making those places more beautiful. Wherever I travel around America, I always visit small towns and small hamlets, where often there were little colleges and little institutions like, again, small colleges. And those were often started by the kinds of people that we would now have taken out of those communities. The small opera houses and the small theaters that used to dot America were started by the philanthropists that lived in those small communities. So there's a reason why I think many of these places are now considered to be dead ends and ugly places, because we've rearranged our society so that the new aristocracy can be congregated in very small number of places around the globe, and we leave these other places where they came from now kind of strip mined, literally depleted of the once valuable resources that might have grown up and lived there.
Yeah, and you'd add the loss of union halls and worker-controlled libraries and those sorts of things to that list.
I certainly would. I mean, the richness of localities, the variety of localities, it seems to me it was one of the, and I don't mean to be nostalgic here, but really was one of the most wonderful things about traveling through America, those kind of old journeys through Route 66, and to see the explosion and the variety of the different libraries and the different kinds of theaters and so forth. It's much more difficult to find those kinds of things now.
Look, let's just end discussing, though, another paradox. And this is something that I know you're concerned about. You are suspicious of central governments with too much power. But again, Patrick, in your country, And you know, as a passionate believer in racial equality, you'll understand this. It did take a strong central government to tell these, self-governing towns or cities or states, look, you don't get to brutalise and discriminate against people because they're black. I mean, so it did take a centralised government, first in Reconstruction after the Civil War, and then sort of 75, 80 years later, they're back again in the 50s and 60s saying the same thing. So, you know, the small-scale self-governance can, in fact, have a very dark side, can't it?
There's absolutely no doubt, and I would be the first, of course, to acknowledge. If I may, I would introduce some Catholic social thought into the conversation, which I'm not. It's not merely that I'm a localist. I think that there's, in some ways, I have a strong impetus to say that as a corrective to the centralizing tendencies of our age, which are both economic and political, that there's a need to stress the local. But it's not merely local for local sake. And I would introduce what I would see as the understanding that arises from Catholic social teaching of subsidiarity, that one always had in evaluating political problems and political issues and economic ones as well, that one has to give, in a sense, a kind of priority or a status, a higher status to the more local solution. So if something can be solved at a local level, one ought to solve it at a local level, because that's the place where people are more likely to care about something, and you're more likely to get actual commitment and actual activity by a variety of people. So I would argue one way to overcome racism is greater interaction with people in their localities, that when you get to know someone, you're more likely to overcome whatever prejudice you might have had. But with that said, subsidiarity says that if a problem can't be solved at a local level, then you need to move up to the next higher level. You don't begin at the central government. You don't begin at a distant power, but you may end up there. And I would say for a variety of issues, I mean, we could think about if there's generational racism, of course, I would say environmental issues are often can't be dealt with or merely dealt with at a local level. How do you solve the problem of climate change, or how do you resolve the problem of overfishing when we're talking about oceans?
And I should just say, your book evinces a deep concern about the way we're treating the natural environment.
So I begin by saying that one of the core principles of liberation is our freedom from other people. But I also go on to say that a core feature has also been the liberation from nature, and that these two things have gone together. And to the extent that we are, I hope many of your listeners are committed to preserving a planet worth living in for us and for future generations, then the idea that we simply live for ourselves and we live in the present and that we simply consume for the sake of our own pleasure has to be corrected by, it seems to me, a different understanding than what lies at the heart of the liberal understanding of the human self.
Patrick Deneen, author of Why Liberalism Failed, ending this week's Religion and Ethics Report. And a big thanks to Mudita Dias and Wayne Ewan. I'm Andrew West. See you soon.